Welcome to Tune My Heart. Yes, that's T-O-O-N as in cartoon. Because in this podcast, we'll be taking a closer look at popular animated movies through a Christian lens in search of faith-relevant themes and traces of eternal truth. I'm your host, Tracy Harold. And just a disclaimer, I'm not a Bible scholar, nor am I a film scholar. I'm just an animation fan who loves Jesus, and who wants to explore how the themes and ideas presented in some of my favorite films might resonate with the Christian faith and help remind us of what we believe, in sometimes surprising ways. So I hope you'll join me as we get animated about our faith. Hey there, and welcome to another episode of Tune My Heart. Proverbs chapter 30, verses 29 through 31 tells us, "There are three things which go well, indeed four are comely in going. A lion, which is strongest among beasts, and does not turn away for any. A strutting rooster, a male goat also, and a king, against whom there is no rising up." Today, we'll be talking about what is surely the comeliest Disney animated movie of all, because while it lacks a rooster and a male goat, it does have a lion and a king. That's right, it's the Lion King. And just to be clear, I hate that we have to specify this, but we are talking about the original animated Lion King from 1994, not the 2017 quote-unquote live-action remake. Now, this feels like a particularly fitting movie to cover in a podcast where we're looking for connections between animated films and Christian faith, because lions are one of the animals mentioned most in the Bible, both literally and symbolically. Most sources that I found seem to agree it's around 150 mentions, or maybe even a little more. Most famous, probably, is the story of Daniel in the lion's den that we all learned back in Sunday school. There's also the stories of Samson killing a lion with his bare hands and David defending his sheep from one. Symbolically, lions, which did live in Israel in ancient times, specifically the Asiatic lion, were used as a symbol of strength and power in the Bible. In Revelation 5:5, Jesus is referred to as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Don't you just love how our Savior is both the lion and the lamb, both gentle and mighty? But lions were used as a symbol of danger as well. In 1 Peter 5:8, we're told, "Be sober and watchful, because your enemy the devil walks around as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." Now, surely I can't be the only kid who grew up in the 90s that pictures Scar from The Lion King whenever I hear that verse. That's just the impact that the movie had on me, and I don't think I'm alone. In fact, I think it's probably impossible to overstate what a phenomenon The Lion King was. I can quote you the stats, of course. It had the highest grossing opening weekend on under 50 screens, beating a record set by Star Wars in 1977. With a worldwide gross of $763.5 million, it became the highest grossing film of 1994, and at that time, it was the second highest grossing film of all time behind Jurassic Park. It was the highest grossing animated film until Finding Nemo came along, and it's still the highest grossing traditionally animated film of all time, and the best-selling film on home video with more than 55 million copies sold. It also inspired Julie Taymor's critically acclaimed Broadway adaptation, which just celebrated its 25th anniversary on Broadway last year. That's right, the play is still running today, and it is the highest-grossing Broadway musical ever. The movie also spawned not one, but two direct-to-video sequels, and they happen to be two of the better ones among the many that Disney pumped out back in those times, as well as two television series. But impressive as all of that is, I'm not sure any of those facts quite manages to capture just what it was actually like back in 1994 when The Lion King came roaring onto the scene, if you'll forgive the pun. Maybe it's partly me looking through nostalgia goggles, although those facts that I just stated seem to back my memories up that this movie was just huge, especially if you were a kid. The film just became a part of the cultural language of our generation. It seems like there was and is still no one who didn't know what Hakuna Matata meant or couldn't recite every joke from the movie from memory. And the merchandising of the film in particular was a level that I don't remember there being with any previous Disney movie. Although maybe it's just that I was at an age where I noticed more because I actually had some of my own money to spend on things. I owned at least a couple of Lion King t-shirts. I bought not only the soundtrack, but also the sequel to the soundtrack, which was called Rhythm of the Pride Lands, which featured songs inspired by the movie, some of which would go on to be used in the Broadway play and in the sequels. And for my sister and I, no trip to Walmart was complete without spending our allowance on at least one new pack of the Lion King trading cards put out by Skybox. I can still recall the anticipation of opening those little foil packets to see what we got. I consider The Lion King to be the peak of the Disney Renaissance. And that's not to say that the movies that came after it were bad, but just that it reached a height in popularity, not to mention box office, that no traditionally animated film afterwards could ever quite match. And the fact that Toy Story came out the next year and began the paradigm shift toward 3D animation probably had something to do with it. In some ways, The Lion King just came out at the very right time. But I also think it is truly deserving of the love it got and still gets from audiences. What makes the incredible success of The Lion King even more astounding is the fact that no one at Disney seemed to expect it, at least not early on. In Pride of the Lion King, which is a short documentary you can find in the extras section for the movie on Disney+, directors Roger Allers and Rob Minkoff, who made their directorial debuts on this film, confessed that they were terrified that they weren't going to live up to the success of the Disney Renaissance movies that came before. They and producer Don Hahn also talk about having to beg artists to work on The Lion King, or King of the Jungle as it was known early on, because given a choice between it and Pocahontas, most of the more experienced animators gravitated toward the latter. The Lion King was considered the B movie, and many of those who stayed on it were younger and less experienced. But that also meant that they had something to prove, and were genuinely passionate about the project, all of which shows in the final product, which is just absolutely gorgeous to look at. Of course, The Lion King isn't just a pleasure for the eyes, but for the ears as well. You have lyrics by Tim Rice, of course, who had also worked on Aladdin. Fun fact, Rice originally suggested ABBA as his collaborators to compose the songs, but they eventually declined, so we ended up with Sir Elton John instead. And as much as I do love me some ABBA, I think it turned out for the best. Every single song they wrote for this movie is simply iconic. It's really hard to choose a favorite. Then, of course, you have the score composed by Hans Zimmer, who had the great wisdom to collaborate with South African composer Lebo M to add the traditional African music and choir elements that make the sound of this film so unique. One of the big reasons that The Lion King ended up being so successful, I think, is because they used the full opening number, The Circle of Life, as the film's trailer, showing it in theaters for months before the movie came out. And the power of that song and the animation accompanying it really amped up everyone's anticipation. Now, I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't mention that, as popular as The Lion King was and still is, it's not without its controversies. The biggest and most enduring of which is the accusation that certain elements and characters may have been inspired by a 1960s Japanese anime series, Jungle Emperor, or as it was known in the US, Kimba the White Lion. This series was created by Osamu Tezuka, and fans of his were understandably upset with the idea that ideas of his might have been used without Disney giving him any credit. For those who aren't familiar, there's a Huffington Post article that gives a pretty good overview of the whole controversy, and I'll link to that in the show notes. For myself, I can see the similarities that people point out, and I wouldn't be surprised to learn that perhaps Kimba did inspire the writers or animators, maybe even unconsciously, but I can also see how the similarities could be coincidental. especially given that both Kimba and The Lion King were inspired by Bambi, as the Huffington Post article points out. And of course, both are set in Africa, so having similar settings and types of animals as characters makes sense. And despite the surface similarities, they are two very different stories, as even Tezuka Productions has pointed out. At the end of the day, only those who made The Lion King know for sure, and they have said repeatedly that they were not influenced by Kimba. In any case, author Roland Keltz records in his book Japan-America: How Japanese Culture Has Invaded the U.S., that Yoshihiro Shimizu, who worked alongside Tezuka and is now a director at Tezuka Productions, stated, "If Tezuka were alive when The Lion King was released, and if he knew about even the rumor that Disney might have copied elements of his work, he would have been proud." So that's a former kids overview of the history and impact of The Lion King. Now let's get a current kids eye view of the movie from my daughter, Darcy.
Hi, my name's Darcy, and Lion King is about Simba and Nala. They got in trouble because they went to this super dangerous place where hyenas lived, and someone was watching them. Scar. After the king was trying to save his son, but then, well, he passed away. And then once that happened, Timon and Pumbaa found him laying around in the sun. The birds were bothering him, and, well, that happened. They were singing the song, "Come on now." That got in my head. After that, for a while, he growed up, teenager, and then king. They never know who was going to be a king, but Nala showed up somehow, and then they were just walking around. Then Nala got kind of frustrated because Simba wouldn't be the king, but then he changed his mind since the monkey guy showed up. And then, after that, he came back. And then, Scar got eaten up by hyenas. And then the end.
Thank you very much, Darcy.
Yeah, and no problems. No, 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 no. No, no, no.
You mean no worries?
No worries.
For the rest of your days.
Next up, as always, is the segment I call Why Is This Not a Christian Movie? This is where we discuss any particular elements of the film that Christians might have a problem with, just to get it out of the way. So as usual, with all of the films we've discussed so far, there's no mention of God in The Lion King. But there are some philosophical and even vaguely religious elements within the film, the most obvious of which is right in that opening song, the idea of the circle of life. As Mufasa explains it to Simba, "Everything you see exists together in a delicate balance. As king, you need to understand that balance and respect all the creatures." He adds, "When we die, our bodies become the grass, and the antelope eat the grass. And so, we are all connected in the great circle of life." I think the concepts of keeping nature's balance and respecting all creatures has the potential to make some Christians uncomfortable. But really, these statements aren't far out of line with the idea that we're supposed to be good stewards of the earth. And in general, the concept of the circle of life just seems to point to the cyclical nature of the world that God created. In fact, Mufasa's point about the lions becoming grass when they die reminds me of what God told Adam in Genesis 3:19. "By the sweat of your face you will eat bread until you return to the ground, because out of it you were taken. For you are dust, and to dust you will return." Of course, we know that we are not only bodies that will die and decay as part of the natural fallen world. We are eternal souls and spirits. And if there is a circle of life at work, if to everything there is a season, as Solomon puts it in Ecclesiastes, it's not because of some impersonal, natural, or cosmic force, but is ultimately guided by the hand and wisdom of God. The Lion King seems to acknowledge something beyond the natural world as well, but the religious beliefs of the lions and other animals is somewhat at odds with Christian belief. Rafiki plays a shaman-like role, performing what seems like an almost religious ceremony when he anoints baby Simba's head and then presents him to the rest of the animals at the beginning of the film. At times, he even seems to have some mystical abilities. Mufasa tells Simba that the great kings of the past are watching over them from the stars, and of course, he himself later appears to Simba in the sky. This might be seen as a form of ancestor worship, I suppose. But if we're honest, even Christians have been known to tell others that a dead loved one is looking down on them from above, inaccurate as that may be. Does any of this mean that Christians should avoid the Lion King? I don't think so personally, and honestly, I've never met anyone who does. But as we've discussed before, each believer should follow their own conscience on what they feel comfortable watching. What I would say is that The Lion King gives us a good opportunity to talk with our kids about what we believe and how it differs from the belief system followed by the characters in the movie and why. Let's teach them that it's okay to enjoy fiction, even fiction that presents a different worldview than ours, as long as we don't turn off our brains and start taking that fiction as fact. Fiction gives us an opportunity to examine ideas, think critically, develop discernment, compare, and contrast. It allows us to find the lessons and ideas that line up with truth and winnow out those that don't, while understanding why they don't and why we might still find them attractive. In other words, fiction, as long as we keep in mind that it is fiction, can be a tool in helping us to refine our minds, just as surely as nonfiction can. Next up is the part of the podcast where I choose a theme Bible verse. Or at least, that's what I normally do here. But with this particular episode, instead of trying to pick just a single verse, I want to look at a story from the Bible instead. Interestingly, as I was researching for this episode, I found that the makers of The Lion King compared it to some famous biblical stories as well. I had heard many times before that The Lion King took inspiration from Bambi and Hamlet, but in a little book called The Journey that was part of The Lion King Special Edition DVD Collector's Gift Set, it's actually stated that as the story of The Lion King developed, those working on it also felt that, quote, there was a connection with other primal stories that have endured for centuries, like the stories of Joseph and Moses from the Old Testament. Producer Don Hahn even writes in the same book, I remember calling my sister and telling her I was working on a film, sort of Moses and Joseph meet Elton John and Hamlet in Africa. I can certainly see the parallels between The Lion King and the stories of both Joseph and Moses. Joseph is the favored son of his father Jacob, as Simba is of Mufasa, sent to a faraway land against his will by the actions of a jealous relative. A famine forces Joseph's brothers to venture far from home, and there they rediscover their brother, who will end up saving their family. Likewise, a scarcity of food in the Pride Lands forces Nala to journey into the jungle, where she finds Simba alive and eventually convinces him to save his pride. The parallels are even stronger when we look at the story of Moses, I think. Moses, raised among royalty, flees into exile when he is accused of a murder, just as Simba does. Though, of course, Moses is actually guilty, while Simba is innocent, though he doesn't realize it. Both find a new family and settle comfortably into a new life, but then are called back to accept the responsibility to rescue their people. Moses by the voice of God out of a burning bush, and Simba by the voice of his father out of the clouds. But as interesting as those connections are, neither of those is the story that I want to focus on for this episode. The story that I want to talk about in relation to The Lion King is not a historical story like those of Joseph or Moses, but actually a parable, perhaps the most famous parable told by Jesus, the one we've come to know as the parable of the prodigal son. Now, I want to give credit where credit is due here. The idea of looking at The Lion King through the lens of the prodigal son is not my own. I actually first came across it in an article posted on a website called Biblical Geek. Unfortunately, that website shut down shortly after I discovered it, but thankfully I had made a copy of the article before that happened. I was also able to find an archived copy of the page using the Internet Archive Wayback Machine, so I will make sure to link to that in the footnotes if you'd like to read it for yourself. I reached out to the author and got his permission to reference his article, which he says was an edited down version of a sermon that he first preached in 2018. So, thank you to Pastor Sean Johnson of North Judson United Methodist Church for the inspiration. Your idea has gone from a sermon to a blog post and now to a podcast. Kind of a circle of life if you think about it. So now let's go ahead and read the parable of the prodigal son found in the Gospel of Luke chapter 15, starting in verse 11. Then he said, "A man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the property that falls to me.' So he divided his estate between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and journeyed to a distant country, and there squandered his possessions in prodigal living. When he had spent everything, there came a severe famine in that country, and he began to be in want. So he went and hired himself to a citizen of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed swine. He would gladly have filled his stomach with the husks that the swine were eating, but no one gave him any. When he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have an abundance of bread, and here I am perishing with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he arose and came to his father. But while he was yet far away, his father saw him and was moved with compassion, and ran and embraced his neck and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. Bring here the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to be merry." Now, that's not the end of the story, but we're going to stop there for now. We will get to the rest of it later on, I promise. One thing I do want to address before I launch into my discussion of the movie, though, is that using this parable as the framework for my analysis means that I am going to be comparing Mufasa to the father in the parable. And since the father represents God, that means I will be comparing Mufasa to God. This seems like a good time to say that any time I make a comparison between a movie character and God or Christ in this podcast, it is never my intention to be irreverent or disrespectful by doing so. And it's also not my intention to say that any character is a perfect picture or representation of God. That's simply impossible because God is perfect. But there may be aspects of a character that can remind us of aspects of God, even imperfectly. Jesus understood this as he frequently used parables like the one we just read, telling his audience about fictional but familiar characters to help them understand aspects of God's character. Stories about people his audience could relate to from their everyday lives, fathers, shepherds, rulers, judges, helped to illustrate that God is the perfectly loving father, the good shepherd, the righteous ruler, the just judge, and so on. Now, I'm not trying to put these secular movies on the same level as Christ's parables either, of course. But I still think that if we look at them through the lens of our faith, we can find comparisons within them that help to remind us of aspects of God's character as well. So we can look at Mufasa, who is a good father and king, as a reminder that we have a more perfect Father and serve the one true King. Now, at last, let's get into the movie. After the opening Circle of Life scene in which baby Simba is presented to his future subjects, we move forward in time and see him now as an adolescent beginning to learn what his place in the world is. His father takes him to the top of Pride Rock and tells him, "Everything the light touches is our kingdom." As he surveys this great kingdom, Simba's eye is quickly drawn away from the light and he asks, "What about that shadowy place?" And Mufasa instructs him that he must never go there. This scene reminds me again of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. They'd been given charge over a beautiful garden in a perfect world and had permission to eat from every tree in the garden except for just one. And that's where temptation struck. And that's so often how we are as well. Instead of gratitude for and contentment with all that we do have and all that we can do, we tend to focus in on the things that we don't or can't have, or that God has told us we shouldn't do. Like Simba, who counters with, "But I thought a king can do whatever he wants." We have a sense of entitlement. We want to have our own way, and we don't want any rules or guidelines holding us back from it. Mufasa tells him that there's more to being a king than getting your way all the time. But Simba, still young and immature, doesn't understand what his father is trying to tell him and responds with, "There's more?" At this stage in his life, he is focused only on the benefits that come with his status as a child of the king, and not on the responsibilities that come with that status. How often does that describe us as Christians? Now that we are children of the king, adopted into his family, do we rest in our own comfort and pleasure, or do we seek for how to serve and share that incredible blessing? As Disney parents go, I think Mufasa and Sarabi are probably some of the best, but they're still not perfect. None of us are, of course. Their biggest fault is that they allow Simba to spend time alone with his Uncle Scar unsupervised. In the previous episode, I talked about the pitfalls of being too overprotective of our children, of keeping them metaphorically locked up in a tower. But there's a danger in swinging the pendulum too far in the other direction and not being protective enough as well. Mufasa knows that his brother is resentful of him and of his son, but he never sees Scar as a serious threat until it's too late. I think that no matter how Scar speaks or behaves, Mufasa still sees him as just his harmless little brother and doesn't believe that he would ever do any real harm. And of course, he turns out to be terribly, terribly wrong about that. This scene also calls to mind another lesson from the previous episode, the importance of community. Isolated from his parents and the rest of his pride, Simba is more vulnerable to temptation and to being misled. His moments alone with Scar are fraught with danger, though he does not realize it. I mentioned 1 Peter 5:8 earlier and how I often picture Scar when I hear or read that verse. "Be sober and watchful, because your enemy the devil walks around as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." Somewhat ironically, Scar actually never roars in this movie, but he does whisper. So it is that, like the serpent drawing Eve's attention to the forbidden fruit in the garden, Scar draws Simba's attention back to the shadowed land that his father told him never to go to. Like the serpent, he deceives Simba into believing that his father is withholding something good from him. Just as the serpent told Eve that if she ate the fruit she would become like God, Scar implies that if Simba goes to the elephant graveyard, he will become like his father. He will be brave. Scar is a tempter, a master manipulator. He knows exactly what breadcrumbs to lay out to get Simba pointed down the wrong path. Let's be clear, though. Scar can tempt, but he does not force Simba to do wrong. Simba is ultimately the one who chooses to disobey his father's instruction. Just as Adam and Eve were responsible for eating the forbidden fruit, and just as we are responsible when we choose to sin. So it is that Simba, in all of his youthful arrogance, heads toward the elephant graveyard with his best friend Nala in tow. And it's on their way that we get Simba's I Want song. Now, if you're not familiar with the term, an I Want song is pretty much exactly what it sounds like. It's a song, usually fairly early in a musical film or play, in which we learn what the main character wants or what they feel is missing from their life. In Beauty and the Beast, for instance, Belle sings, I want adventure in the great wide somewhere. In Tangled, the song When Will My Life Begin gives us insight into Rapunzel's longing to leave her tower and see the floating lights. And in The Lion King, the I want takes the form of I just can't wait to be king, a song which again shows Simba's immaturity and provides us with our first connection to the prodigal son story. As Pastor Johnson pointed out in his article, when the prodigal son asks for his share of the inheritance, he is essentially saying to his father, I wish you were dead, because normally an inheritance is only passed down upon the father's death. Likewise, as Simba is joyfully singing about how he can't wait to be king, he is essentially saying that he can't wait for his father to die, because that is how he will become king. Now, the difference is that while the prodigal son almost certainly understood the implication of his words, Simba doesn't. He's self-centered, as young people tend to be, but he's also naive and clearly doesn't understand what his father actually meant when he talked earlier about the sun setting on his time as king and rising on Simba's. This song is an excellent example of dramatic irony, where the audience understands the full significance and import of a character's words better than the character himself does. The song demonstrates again as well that Simba still thinks being king is all about fun and freedom, all about self, rather than about responsibility to others. What's interesting is that Scar is in some ways a mirror of Simba in this regard, as we find out in what could be said to be his own I Want song, and is, in my opinion, one of the best villain songs of all time, Be Prepared. Maybe that's why he's so good at manipulating Simba. He also doesn't see being king as being primarily about responsibility. He sees it as being about power, about being king, undisputed, respected, saluted, and seen for the wonder I am. Mufasa's attitude toward leadership calls to mind Christ's words in Matthew 20:26. Whoever would be great among you, let him serve you. Scar, on the other hand, doesn't want to serve, but to be served. Simba does too. But whereas Simba's selfish attitude toward kingship can be chalked up to innocent childishness, Scar is an adult driven purely by jealousy and pride. Simba is young and naive, but Scar has no such excuse. And I really believe that if not for Scar's machinations, Simba would have naturally grown out of his self-centered attitude with time. Because as I said earlier, he has pretty great parents. The scene after he and Nala are rescued by Mufasa from the elephant graveyard is probably the best illustration of that fact. As he speaks with Simba alone, Mufasa manages to perfectly balance correction with affection. He makes it clear to his son that he is disappointed and angry, but he also makes it clear that those feelings ultimately stem from his great love for him. He is both stern and caring, and he seeks to understand why Simba did what he did, instead of simply punishing him for it, and then to help Simba understand, in turn, why his motivation, his wanting to prove himself to be brave like his father, was misguided. We go straight from that beautiful nighttime scene between father and son to a scene in the full glaring light of day between uncle and nephew. And I think the stark contrast in that transition is intentional, because these two authority figures in Simba's life could not be more different. Mufasa offers genuine love and loving correction. Scar, on the other hand, pretends to be loving toward his nephew only as a guise to use guilt and shame to manipulate him once again, reminding him of his misadventure in the elephant graveyard and his little roar to get him to unknowingly cooperate with his uncle's plot. The infamous wildebeest stampede scene follows, with Mufasa risking his life to save Simba's, and then ultimately losing his life due to his brother's betrayal. Simba finding his father and trying ineffectually to wake him up and to call for help is truly one of the most heartbreaking scenes in any animated film, especially with Hans Zimmer's poignant score playing in the background. And into the midst of that heartbreak walks Scar, ready to manipulate once again when Simba is at his most vulnerable. He tells Simba that he is responsible for his father's death, and in his distress, Simba absorbs that lie as truth. This again reminds me of Satan, who is called the Accuser in Revelation 12:10, who wants to heap guilt and blame onto us, both deserved and undeserved, to constantly remind us of every sin and mistake even after they've been forgiven. Scar twists the knife even deeper by asking, "What will your mother think?" And then he encourages Simba to run away. If Simba had only stayed and gone to his mother and told her what happened, he surely would have been told that it was not his fault. Facing our guilt by confessing our faults, whether they are real or imagined, is the best way to absolve our guilt. If we instead try to run from our guilt, as Simba does at Scar's direction, it will continue to haunt us no matter how far we flee. Ironically, Simba has gotten exactly what he thought he wanted. He is now king, or would be if he'd stayed behind in the Pride Lands. Instead, like the prodigal son, he journeys to a distant country, seeking to leave his old life behind. There he is taken in by Timon and Pumbaa and taught to live by their no-worries motto, Hakuna Matata. Now, that philosophy might sound pretty good on the surface. After all, Jesus told his followers not to worry, didn't he? But the problem with the Hakuna Matata lifestyle that Timon and Pumbaa advocate is that it's not really just about no worries. As Timon says at one point in the middle of the song, it's also about no rules and no responsibilities. It's not just about not worrying about anything, it's about not caring about anything, or anyone. Timon also says, when the world turns its back on you, you turn your back on the world. Clearly, these two characters have been hurt by the world, so they've decided to try to leave the world behind and live only for themselves. Even when they save Simba, it's initially only because they think it will be beneficial to them to have a lion on their side. They also sing that Hakuna Matata is a problem-free philosophy. But problems are a part of life that no one can avoid. What they're really advocating for is ignoring or running away from their problems. And since that's what Simba was already doing, that appeals to him, even if it means switching from a diet of antelope to a diet of grubs. This is one parallel to the prodigal son story that I think is kind of funny. The prodigal son becomes so desperately hungry that he wishes he could eat the pig's food, a detail that surely would have horrified Jesus's Jewish audience when he told it. In The Lion King, Simba, in order to survive in his new life, has to learn to eat the same food as a pig, or, you know, a warthog, grubs and insects, a detail that never fails to garner some ewes from the audience on their first viewing. Unlike the prodigal son, however, this is not enough to convince Simba to return to his old life. Instead, he embraces Hakuna Matata, new diet and all. Interestingly enough, his life with Timon and Pumbaa ends up being a lot like what he envisioned being king would be like when he was a naive little cub. A carefree life full of fun, where he gets to do whatever he wants whenever he wants, with no concern for anyone else and no responsibilities. But of course, it's the opposite of what his life as king was supposed to be. And as hard as he tries, he cannot forget who he really is, or the past that he's tried to run from. That fact becomes apparent in the stargazing scene, where he shares with his friends the idea that his father once shared with him, that the great kings of the past are looking down on them from the stars. Unfortunately, his friends only answer this moment of vulnerability with laughter. Now, just as a famine occurs in the prodigal son's story, there is a famine in Simba's story as well, though he is, as yet, unaffected by it. In fact, while he's still living comfortably in the jungle with Timon and Pumbaa, the Pride Lands, under Scar's selfish and irresponsible rule, have turned into a wasteland devoid of food and water. It's a picture that calls to mind Proverbs 29:2. When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice, but when the wicked rule, the people mourn. Or in this case, the birds mourn, as we open on Zazu singing, "Nobody knows the trouble I've seen." Scar tells him to lighten up, and then becomes further frustrated as even his once loyal hyenas come complaining about the lack of food. Of course, Scar still takes no responsibility for the problems in his kingdom, or for their solutions, simply saying dismissively, "It's the lioness's job to do the hunting." He still wants all of the power of leadership, with none of the sacrifice. So it is that Nala leaves the Pride Lands in search of food and discovers her old friend Simba, who Scar had proclaimed was lost along with Mufasa, alive and well. She says to him, "It's like you're back from the dead," calling to mind the father's words in the prodigal son story, "For this son of mine was dead and is alive again." But when Nala says, "You're alive, and that means you're the king," Simba balks. He insists not once but twice, "No, I'm not the king," denying his true identity, and essentially denying whose son he is. Though he's happy to see Nala, he's not ready to truly be alive again to the entire pride, and to accept all the possible consequences that would entail. When Nala asks why he hasn't returned in all of this time, he flippantly says, "I just needed to get out on my own, live my own life. And I did, and it's great." And if that doesn't sound like something the prodigal son would say before he repented and returned to his family, I don't know what does. Of course, this angers Nala, who has had to suffer through all of the consequences of Simba's absence while he was off living his own life. And when Simba again tries to brush her off with Hakuna Matata and "Why worry?", she answers, "Because it's your responsibility." Whew. When I was rewatching the movie and Nala said those words, I wanted to stand up and applaud. Because if it's not clear by now, I think the need to accept responsibility is a big theme in this film. So it was nice to hear her say it. Simba storms off, but his anger soon turns to sorrow. He looks up at the sky and cries out, "You said you'd always be there for me, but you're not. And it's because of me. It's my fault." This moment is so heartbreaking, maybe partly because most of us can relate to losing someone we love and not having them there anymore. But also, if we look at it metaphorically, Simba crying out to his father feels a lot like us crying out to our heavenly father, and sometimes feeling like he's not really there or not really hearing us, and that maybe it's our fault. That maybe he's turned his back on us because of something we've done. Many of us have cried out at one time or another, as David did in Psalm 22, and as Jesus did on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me?" But Christian, take heart. No matter how we feel and no matter what we've done, once we have been adopted into God's family through faith in Christ, nothing can ever truly cause him to forsake us. As Romans 8:38 through 39 says, "For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, neither angels nor principalities nor powers, neither things present nor things to come, neither height nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord." And Simba is soon to learn that his father hasn't forsaken him either. Rafiki tells him that his father is still alive, and then leads him to a pool of water and tells him to look. Of course, Simba sees only his own reflection, but Rafiki tells him, "He lives in you." Much as we Christians have the Holy Spirit living in us, and are supposed to be reflections of God to the world. But in case that wasn't enough, Mufasa himself then appears to Simba in the clouds above and tells him, "You have forgotten who you are, and so have forgotten me." By denying his own identity as the rightful king, Simba has also denied his identity as Mufasa's son. When we try to run from God or from the responsibilities he has placed in our lives, as the prodigal son ran from his father and his responsibilities, we forget our own true identities as well. By trying to live for ourselves, we actually lose ourselves, because at heart, who we are is our father's children. Which brings us to the turning point of the prodigal son's story, verses 18 and 19. When he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have an abundance of bread, and here I am perishing of hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you.'" When reading this story, I've always been struck by the words, "when he came to himself." It's like the prodigal son, who thought he was living for himself, but was actually living against himself, finally remembers who he is, which is tied inextricably to who his father is. As Simba sees the vision of his father, he too is beginning to come to himself, but still he hesitates. "How can I go back?" he asks. "I'm not who I used to be." Like the prodigal son, he is saying to his father what he believes to be true in his guilty heart. "I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But Mufasa simply tells him, "Remember who you are. You are my son and the one true king." Sometimes we may feel, like Simba, that we have changed too much, wandered too far, and we can't go back to God. But like the prodigal son's father, God is always waiting for us to return with open arms. If we are saved, then like Simba, our identity is already set in stone, and no circumstance or feeling can change it. As Galatians 4:7 says, "Therefore you are no longer a servant, but a son, and if a son, then an heir of God through Christ." We just need to remember who we are. That doesn't mean that we won't ever have any hurt to face. As Rafiki says to Simba, the past can hurt, but you can either run from it or learn from it. Running from it, as Simba has been trying to do all this time, won't stop it from hurting, but learning from it can bring some good out of that hurt. So we next see the scene of Simba running, no longer running away, but running toward his past and his responsibility. And as he arrives at the edge of the Pride Lands, Nala joins him, as do Timon and Pumbaa, showing their true colors. Although they may have taken in Simba at first for their own selfish reasons, they have grown to genuinely love and care for him and are now loyal to his cause. Meanwhile, Simba proves that he is finally ready to accept his role, saying, "This is my kingdom. If I don't fight for it, who will?" Scar, meanwhile, still has the attitude of a petulant child toward his kingly responsibilities and rights. "I am the king," he declares to Sarabi. "I can do whatever I want." As Simba charges onto the scene to defend his mother, interestingly, both she and Scar mistake him at first for Mufasa. By accepting his responsibility, he has finally become the reflection of his father that he hoped to be back when he was a cub trying to prove his courage. But he also needs to face the pain of his past and accept responsibility for what he believes to be his sin, his part in the death of his father. And Scar all too happily latches on to his confession, once again playing the accuser, as he calls Simba a murderer and proclaims, "You're guilty," over Simba's feeble attempts to explain that it was an accident. Scar's accusations undermine Simba's confidence, just as Satan's accusations so often do to us. Simba once again forgets who he is under the onslaught of Scar's words, and he finds himself timidly backing away until he slips and ends up dangling off a cliff, just as his father once did. Fortunately, at this point, when he thinks he has won, Scar cannot resist telling Simba the truth, that he is the one who killed Mufasa. And that truth finally sets Simba free. He leaps back onto solid ground and forces Scar to confess to everyone. And then the battle truly begins. As Scar tries to flee, Simba pursues and corners him. And once again, Scar denies personal responsibility for his sins, claiming, "It's the hyenas who are the real enemy. It was their fault. It was their idea." Simba sees through this lie, of course. But he offers Scar mercy, telling him to run away and never return. But Scar shows his true nature once more as he uses this offer of mercy to try to get the upper hand against Simba. He still loses the fight, though, and is sent hurtling down to the ground below. And here he finally reaps the reward for all of his passing the blame, as the hyenas, who just heard him declare them the enemy, are all too happy to become exactly that. So the battle is over, Scar is defeated, and the rains begin to fall, symbolically cleansing the land of his evil influence. Simba slowly ascends Pride Rock. The prodigal son has returned home, and the father welcomes him with one final reminder to remember. And Simba does remember. He has come to himself. With a roar, he claims his rightful place as king, accepting his identity and all of the responsibilities that go along with it. The movie ends fittingly with a reprise of the Circle of Life and a repetition of the scene we saw at the beginning, with a young cub, this time Simba and Nala's child, being presented to the animals of the Pride Lands as their future ruler. But of course, that's not how the story of the prodigal son ends. And to understand why, we need to go back to the beginning of the story. The very first sentence of the story, in fact. A man had two sons. You see, the story that we know as the prodigal son isn't actually just the story of one son. It's the story of two. We've covered the younger son's story, but what about the older son? Let's pick up where we left off before, after the younger son returns home and is accepted back by his father with love and celebration, starting in Luke 15, verse 25. Now his older son was in the field. As he came and drew near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked what this meant. He said to him, "Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him safe and sound." He was angry and would not go in. Therefore, his father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, "Look, these many years have I served you, nor have I ever transgressed your commands. Yet never have you given me a goat so that I might be merry with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your living with harlots, you killed the fattened calf for him." He said to him, "Son, you are always with me, and all that I have is yours. But it was fitting to be merry and be glad, for this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." To understand why Jesus includes the story of the older son, we need to go back even further in the chapter to verse 1, where we find out what inspired him to tell this parable, along with the parable of the lost sheep and the parable of the lost coin, in the first place. Luke 15:1 says, "Now all the tax collectors and sinners drew near to him to hear him. But the Pharisees and scribes murmured, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.'" The character of the older son was designed to be a reflection of these Pharisees and scribes, who saw themselves as righteous and therefore deserving of God's love and blessings, but could not understand why Jesus would seek to extend God's mercy and grace to undeserving tax collectors and sinners. If we're honest, we can find the older son very relatable as well. In his place, we would probably all feel the same way, which should be a reminder to us of our own need to learn humility. But who plays the role of the older son in The Lion King? After giving it some thought, I think it's Simba. Okay, hear me out. Simba in The Lion King, the movie that we just went over, is definitely more comparable to the younger son. But Simba in The Lion King 2 is more like the older son. If you haven't seen The Lion King 2, I do recommend you check it out. As I said earlier, it's one of the better of the direct-to-video sequels that Disney made. You can tell that some real effort was put into it, and while it doesn't quite match up to the original, it's still worth seeing, in my opinion. Unfortunately, I don't have time to do a full overview of The Lion King 2, but the basic premise behind the plot of the movie is that there were some members of the Pride who were actually loyal to Scar. So Simba has banished these lions from the Pride Lands and labeled them as outsiders. Which kind of reminds me of the scribes and Pharisees labeling some people sinners, as if we're not all sinners. Or the older son seeing his younger brother not through the same merciful eyes of his father as a beloved one returned from the dead, but rather as one who has devoured his father's living with harlots. In a way, Simba has once again forgotten who he is. Oh, he knows now that he is Mufasa's son and therefore the rightful king, but he has forgotten that he also spent years unfaithful to Mufasa's teachings and had to come back seeking forgiveness and redemption. Instead, he sees himself and the other loyal members of the Pride as righteous, and the outsiders who serve Scar as irredeemable. He's become so determined to prove himself a faithful son by enforcing his father's laws that he cannot see anything of himself in these traitors and has no desire to extend the same mercy and grace to them that he once needed himself. It's interesting to me that Jesus concluded the parable of the prodigal son where he did, never telling his audience how the older son ultimately responded to his father's admonition. If I had to guess, I think maybe that's because he wanted the scribes and Pharisees listening to realize that they were the older son, and that therefore it was up to them to decide how the story ended. Simba's animosity toward the outsiders in The Lion King 2 has a clearer resolution, but I won't spoil it for you here. Like I said, if you haven't seen the movie, I do recommend you check it out. But now it's time to wrap this episode up, and I've decided to do so by quoting the final words from Pastor Johnson's article, which I think sum up things pretty well. Throughout our days, it seems we tend to go in a circle of life, where we continually lose track of where we should be and need to be reminded of who we are. We can be guilty of forgetting that we are children of God, meant to be in relationship with God. There are times when we are like the prodigal son. We are not obedient to God, we turn away from what we know is right, and we do what we know is wrong. We are selfish, prideful, and unfaithful. We might even delude ourselves that what we are doing is not bad or it is even virtuous as we discover ourselves or live in the moment. However, if you remember the times you have been down that windy and wrong road, you know those are empty lies we tell ourselves. Then there are times when we are like the older son. We go through the motions of being obedient to the Father, but it is just that, motions. It is an empty duty full of resentment, not a loving relationship. We are quick to see the slights done against us and we are long to hold a grudge. We can fall into horrible ways of thinking where we pay lip service to mercy, but we do not seem to actually think much of it. Instead of offering love and forgiveness to those in need, we cross our arms and self-righteously declare, God only helps those who help themselves. We may play the role of the obedient child, but the reality is the fire has cooled and been replaced by far too much bitterness. When we find ourselves on those extremes, we need to return to our center. We need to remember who we are. We are God's children. It does not matter what you have done. It does not matter who you have hated or how bitter you have acted. God still loves you. And if you turn back to God, then God will run to meet you where you are at. And that concludes this episode of Tune My Heart. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, you can find more episodes at tunemyheart.com or by searching for Tune My Heart on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon, Audible, pretty much anywhere that you like to listen to podcasts. Please follow the podcast at Tune My Heart. Remember, that's T-O-O-N on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the podcast, the biggest thing you can do is just to let other people know about it. You can do that by leaving a rating or a review wherever you're listening. You can do it by telling your friends and sharing the episodes on social media. And of course, you can just tell your friends in person. I know, crazy idea. Also, if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions or ideas, please feel free to reach out by email, tunemyheartpodcast@gmail.com. I am your host, Tracy Harold, and until next time, remember who you are.